I make a good pot of beans. Christians like my beans. Right wing, left wing, they like my beans. Buddhists like my beans. Muslims and Jews like my beans. Agnostics and atheists, Mexicans and gringos, vegetarians and meat eaters. Even Phyllis and Bill like my beans. Does Megan like my beans? Yes, yes. Megan likes my beans. They all like my beans. The drunks down the street like my beans. And I know some politicians who like my beans. Likewise, ex-cons and thieves, friends of mine, all of them. Poets, of course, like my beans. Perhaps some novelists, who knows? A few holy men, a few holy women, not too many wise folks out there. Be careful who you listen to. My kids and grandkids like my beans. My wife likes my beans. She really likes it when I cook my beans. Write me a letter, a real letter, the old-fashioned way. Buy a stamp, a postcard. I'll send you the recipe for my beans. Actually, the interesting thing about that poem is that people don't think of that metaphorically. They think of it literally. And I've been getting a number of letters in the mail asking for the recipe for my beans. That makes me proud.
If you don't know that voice reading his poem, "I Make a Good Pot of Beans," then you have missed one of the tastiest treats in poetry for miles around. My guest is poet and publisher Bobby Bird, here to tell us about his latest book of poetry, "Otherwise My Life is Ordinary." Welcome, Bobby. It's always such a treat.
Oh, it's a joy to be back, Monica.
I love having you here. And I just am listening to you read about your pot of beans. And somehow I missed the fact that you are a Zen master when I started reading up on you. And I thought, well, golly, I didn't realize that. I should have known.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say a master. I get sort of worried about the words people throw around.
Well,
but I'm a teacher, yeah, and I'm a priest. But
a Zen priest.
A Zen priest.
I used the wrong
term. Well, no, master is good. A lot of people use it.
Oh,
but,
okay.
You know, Zen is an important part of my life, and we sit every week, and I'm the leader of the group, so.
When did you begin studying Zen?
It's been a back-and-forth thing with me. Probably, you know, I started when I was in the 60s reading about it, you know, and with all the beats and stuff, and I became very interested. I read all of Alan Watts and all of D.T. Suzuki and stuff. But, you know, to practice Zen means you have to sit down and stare at the wall or meditate, do Zazen. And so I didn't really start into that until the 80s. And then there was a sort of a hiatus, and then, if that's the right word, and then again in the 90s and very seriously in like 1999.
What were you trying to solve hard enough to make you sit down and stare at the wall?
Well, you know, all my life I've always had sort of a nagging feeling of being unsatisfied, even at the happiest parts of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at the saddest parts of my life. And even the probably the worst is during the periods of ennui, of boredom, you know, where you just, it's not, you're sort of unsatisfied. And Buddhism, Zen in particular, says that, you know, each moment is perfect and that we should learn to understand that. And so that feeling, that thought sort of resonates in my life. And I've never been satisfied with other practices. And with this, though, it sort of has become a deep food for me.
I love something that you said in an essay titled "How Did This Happen?" that you wrote in memory of Paul Blackburn, mentor and friend. You said, "My poetics are simple enough, nothing new really, no manifesto. I believe in those experiences that open up holes of understanding."
Right.
Why wouldn't you equate this dissatisfaction with just being a poet, that sense of angst of needing to create? Does that line
well,
up?
You know, it's a different thing. You know, they probably feed off of the same thing. And a lot of times, you know, as my life passes, you know, I don't feel, I guess, egotistically the need to be a poet. When I write now, I write because I really have something I want to say, and that it's sparked by an incident like I talk about in the essay. But I think there are pieces of our lives that meditation practice or Zazen or Zen practice opens up for us. But, you know, I think it's common in all of our lives, you know, that we have these little bits where we look over our shoulder and we see something that just wakes us up, and all the sort of baggage that we carry around in our lives sort of disappears and we understand something.
The moments, the aha moments.
Yeah.
Well, you wrote a poem about Juarez that has a strong Zen streak through it. Let's hear that one.
Okay. In memory of a famous poet, 2010, this is a poem I wrote when all the violence, of course, a lot of it's still happening in Juarez, but this is sort of in the midst of it. Like a lot of the folks in this world in El Paso, I was terribly concerned about it. In memory of being a famous poet, 2010, being a famous poet is not like being famous, John Ashbery. If I move 3 miles into Mexico, I live in El Paso, I could be shot for being a poet. In fact, I could be shot for being alive. Dead, I would be innocent. That's what Amado Carrillo Fuentes said. Only the dead are innocent. He died on an operating table, trying to get a new face. He no longer wanted to be himself. But Amado was not a poet. He was a narco-trafficante and a murderer, a vicious and evil man. Although now he is innocent, according to his own definition. Me, I could be dead for the sin of being a poet, for the sin of being alive. Guilty as charged. Maybe I would also be famous then, at least for a couple of days. My wife would be weeping on CNN. She'd sell a few of my poetry books.
I love that. It's interesting that even the quote in that poem is a poet reflecting on his reality kind of as a poet. There's this fun, this self-deprecating thing about being a poet. I think you were the first one to crack me up completely with what was the line about not making money. You're certainly not.
Oh, yeah. I'm always referring to the fact that I don't make any money.
Yes.
Well, both as a poet or as a publisher.
Yeah, double whammy there. Well, in case anybody isn't aware of who they're listening to, of course, Bobby Bird and his wife, Lee Bird, have Cinco Puntos Press, which has just distinguished itself nationally, internationally, an amazing press. And I'm assuming this is where we can get, otherwise my life is ordinary.
Yeah, we have the copies.
I suspected you might. And we can go to cincopuntos.com to order, or we can visit you down on Texas Street. What's what's the number on Texas?
701 Texas,
and it's you know,
it's a fun place to come.
Absolutely, be prepared to walk away with more than one book. By the way,
oh good.
In reading about you, my favorite poets come up: William Carlos Williams and Basho.
Uh huh. Oh yeah.
Absolutely, the two I love.
I have a poem for Basho when in the book where he comes to visit me.
Oh yes.
It's called "Far Roads to Distant Towns," which is the title of one of his collections.
Oh, I haven't.
I can't read it on the air.
I want to read it even more now. But you seem to always be talking to someone in your head.
Right.
This brings a wonderful conversational quality to your poetry that
I like my poetry. It's not always like that, but most of the time it's plain spoken. Like a friend of mine told me once, Polly Pettis, she said, reading my work is like riding in a car talking to Bobby Bird, except with fewer words. And I thought, well, that's perfect. You know, I'll use that. So I just
It's so relaxed and a beautiful, fun examination of dynamics. Tell me your most powerful influence as a child. What do you think struck to your core and made you in part who you are?
Well, as I mentioned the essay, you know, there are two women in my life. My dad died when I was two, and my mother had to raise us, and this was 1944, and women didn't go out in the world and make a living at that time. And so she was selling real estate, and this black woman, Darthula Baldwin, who, because I couldn't say Darthula, her name became Tula. My three siblings and I, or my three siblings and me, were raised by her.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, she became a very important mother figure. And, you know, people would call her now perhaps a mammy or a nanny or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I would, to me, she's Tula. And source, I think, both my mother and Tula are the source of a great deal of my poetry and also my politics, I think, which tend to be on the left side of the wall.
Well, then they roam through your head and your poems liberally. And your reference also to black culture and its music as being just the lifeblood of when you were a young man.
Yeah,
to you.
I think, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and it was during for Memphis, the golden age of music. And me and my classmates, we never went to school with a person of color. So these black musicians were teaching us all these things that just, they taught us about our bodies. They taught us that, you know, sex was a joyous thing. It's nothing to had to. And they taught us to move, you know. Get up and dance, white boy.
Again, if you don't know the work of poet Bobby Bird, he's the publisher also of Cinco Puntos Press, along with his lovely wife, Lee Bird. You are in for a treat. You've got to get Otherwise My Life is Ordinary. You can do that through cincopuntos.com or drop by 701 Texas and meet the man himself. A wonderful book from an extraordinary individual. And to hear Bobby read his work live, be at Eloisa. That's on Shadow Mountain, the cafe, on June 25th, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. Bobby, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, Monica, you're a pro.